Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us the rotation out of pricey high-tech stocks continued. Gold had a downturn and bounced back, but silver didn't recover as quickly. There's now a wide divide between the long and shorts for the Canadian dollar. One of Canada's top real estate agents, Alan Markangel, checks out the pricey side of home buying in West Vancouver. He tells us Chinese homeowners who used to never sell are now doing something much different. Our San Francisco correspondent, Wolf Richter, dives into what's happening with the housing market in Canada and the U.S., the automotive sector, and whether it's getting more affordable to buy a new set of wheels no matter what form of power it uses. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always good to be with you, Jim.
What happened on the stock markets this week?
Well, you know, the rotation has started here about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Small caps starting to come to life. People finding that valuations finally are starting to matter rather than just pure upside growth in the Mag 7. And it is good to see. You know, we ended up now with finally getting, say, the correction in these big names that I've been hoping for. You had the first leg to the downside and a pretty good bounce at the end of the week as far as the S&P was concerned. Not too much of a recovery in the NASDAQ, and I think that's due to the fact that, you know, you got such overvaluations there on this this run in the last number of months that it's time for a breather. And, you know, the other side of the coin, you look to see where is the money moving to when it starts to move away from those other items. And, you know, the money's slowly going to take some profits on the high flyers. And when you look around, the healthcare stocks doing really nicely. The healthcare index this week just pulled back to a breakout and then is right back to its highs. Same thing over in biotech and the pharmaceuticals. They are trending nicely. You know, they've only really come to life here starting about 2-3 weeks ago, and they've held their gains exceptionally well. So, you know, the money's shifting over there. And over on the financials, the XLF, and then you look at the REITs, the Real Estate Investment Trusts, doing really nicely at this point. They bottomed out in May through June. Good breakout 2 weeks ago. Got a little overbought, but the consolidation in these sectors that we've just mentioned, most of them have been consolidating for the better part of 6 to 9 months. And these breakouts have probably got a fair amount of potential left in them. So if we're going to go through what I think might be a rotational top here, where the S&P and the NASDAQ possibly go back to retest their highs, but not move dramatically on the upside, the easy money for a while is going to be in these other sectors, which had been the laggards and are now coming back in favor.
What's going on with gold and silver?
Big hiccup there in the early part of the week. The gold market really ended up taking it on the nose. A kind of fits the modeling that we've been looking at. We mentioned a week ago that monthly chart was producing a very uncommon, I should say, sell signal. We've got 9 of these signals since 1980, and the most recent one was back in 2021 when we were first time that we were up to 2,000. The previous time was back in 2011 when we were trying to get through 1,800. So this time around at 2,500, we got big overbought on the monthly charts. The probability is that we could correct back maybe into 2,100, that range. We're just around 2,400, so there's, a chance for a decent correction there. That's on the probably looking over the period of months. And on the hourly and daily charts, excess has happened on the upside 2 weeks ago, hard correction into the middle of this week, and a bounce on Friday. But I think as long as spot price stays below, let's call it 2440, and the nearest futures below 2450, that resistance is going to be pretty difficult to push through. And over on the silver market, it's been weaker than gold the last little while, and we are probably looking at that one continuing to ease lower. I don't see too much of big upside potential there for the next month or so.
What's going on with crude?
Fair amount of just volatility in that market, within tight trading ranges on the week. It started off up around the $82 range, got down to 76 and change, and closed off at 78. If anything, getting a little oversold right now, but we are in a weak part of the seasonal as far as the crude oil is concerned. So I'm going to continue to watch for that one to ease lower for now. And, there's times to be, overweight in certain areas, and this is one of those times to be underweight.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
The U.S. dollar and bouncing pretty small trading range, 104 and a quarter right now on the dollar index. Once again, inside this broad, what do we call it, about a 3-month trading range, 106 down to 104. And the moves this week in terms of the CPI numbers and the potential for rate cuts is such that you're not seeing any push from the interest rate side of things. So pretty quiet as far as the dollar index is concerned. Some of the individual currencies, when we look at them, like the British pound, are up into selling territory right now. Don't talk about the pound that often, but we are definitely at the point where a sell signal looks to be coming in place, and for the currency traders, that would be something to take a look at. The Canadian dollar, another poor week over there. We are, gosh, it's now multiple weeks here where the commercials are establishing long positions, and the speculators, both the small and large ones, are just continuing to build their short positions to levels that we haven't seen in years. The trend is down, and the trend is your friend until it ends. When this thing turns, it could be a pretty significant one. So for all that, you might want to be in the Canadian dollar on the short side, I'd be holding some pretty tight stops on those positions.
On the commodity front, is coffee about to make a big charge like cocoa did?
It's been a while since we had a run in coffee, and, we are, at this point, we've had three sort of bangs on the buck up at 240 in the last 6 months. It seems to be eating away at that resistance, and it looks as though this sort of dominant uptrend that we've got here might be ready to pop through and put in some higher levels. So, think about not making quite so many trips to Starbucks.
Ross, thank you so much.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Alan Mark Angel next on This Week in Money.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Alan Mark Angel, one of the top realtors in Canada. He has sold more than 4,000 properties. He's located in West Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada's most expensive postal code. You can find him online at theangelgroup.com. That's spelled A-N-G-E-L-L group.com. Alan, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Glad to be here.
What's the latest on your Angel Hassman expansion?
It's been outstanding because the market's grim. Last year was the second worst year in history, third worst the year before that, and this year is certainly as bad. But we've expanded the company because in West Vancouver, where my office was, I get 100 realtors and. We do less than one sale a realtor. Last year, we had 0.8 sales per realtor. That's the lowest in any area in Greater Vancouver area. And so, and the amazing thing, the top area, Squamish, sells five sales a realtor. So in our area in West Vancouver, I mean, less than one sale a realtor, we had 789 realtors, and we had like 670 sales, houses and apartments. So that's how bad it is, but these new offices have doubled our sales plus. We went from 47 sales a month to now 120. So it's been great because everybody wants the high-end name. Ours is, our company. We've been involved in the biggest sales here in the North Mainland. And everybody wants to be able to sell high houses. So we have to turn people away in our office now. So it's great. So even though the market sucks, we're back to making money because of all the new offices.
What are your stats showing for the first half of this year?
Well, the interesting thing is my stats, I do all the stats for just Greater Vancouver. Then I do all the West Bend, North Bend, all the way to Langley, because I've got a Whistler office, Langley, White Rock, 14 areas, okay? So I just did them to the end of June. And like the Greater Vancouver, the average is 7,700 a year. The best is 12,400. The worst is 4,439 as of the end of June, but at that time, the end of June. So we're having 4,132. So 8 of the 14 areas for the first 6 months are having the worst 6 months they've ever had. My stats go back to at least 1991 for all areas, and like West Bend's 83, North Bend's 87. So 8 of the 14 areas are lowest amount of sales that they've ever had. So they'll tell you all you need to know. But believe it or not, I'm optimistic about the market. Anyway, I'll talk about that in a while. So the stats are not great.
Mm-hmm. Are the months of inventory increasing?
Yes, they've gone up. If you look at the Greater Vancouver, has increased since January 30%. Some are 38%, some are 40%. So yes, they're increasing a lot of our. In West Bend, we've gone from 360 to 529 amount of product.
How are West Vancouver waterfront properties selling?
Well, we've done 4 so far this year, and the average year, I mean, we've had as high as 36 years ago, but the average year is 12, so we're at 4, the average is 12.
What do those go for?
Well, the ocean fronts basically start maybe 10 million, 12 million, and in West Van, there's been 2 sales over 30 million in history. They were both ours, and actually, the street I sold, that was my first waterfront sale. I sold one there for $110,000. That was my first waterfront sale. And since that time, there's been 2 over 30.
How are West Vancouver high-end, really high-end properties selling?
Well, if you go over 10, there's 3 sales. The average per year is 7. So it isn't as bad. But the only difference is there's a lot more for sale. A lot more for sale. We used to sell 3, 4, or 5, but you had maybe 10 on the market, and now you get up to 30, 40 on the market. So when it's only 7, it's not great.
Are they up for sale because the new mortgage rates are just too high?
Well, most of the people who own the waterfront have been there a long time. Like all the guys, I golf at Capilano, and there's 16 guys in our group and golf there Saturdays, and known them for years. I've filled them all houses. 9 of them live on the water, but they've been there for years and years and years. So it isn't that bad. And most of them stay there now because all these guys are going to have to sell. They're going to make me a lot of money in the late years, but they're all in their 70s and 80s, but they're putting elevators in their houses. So they're all staying there so they don't have to move to an apartment.
Is that a lot of the cases here in Vancouver? We live in a really nice area. You don't want to move out.
No, you didn't have elevators in houses. Now they're all over the place, because everybody had to move because of the stairs. And so, you know, you just got older and you don't want the stairs. In fact, I just moved because my wife fell down the stairs. She had to call 911. She's got a concussion. She wanted out of the big house. And so I don't have an elevator. I hadn't thought about putting an elevator in mine. But there's so many that I just put a house on the market. My largest client I've ever had, I've sold them 64 houses in my career, and you know they built a beautiful brand new house, and they got an elevator. It changes, it's changed our business completely because of the elevators.
Maybe you should get into the elevator business.
Well, you know it's handy.
What's happening in the pre-sale market?
Well, that's changed over the last few years. See, the old days, pre-sales were great. Everybody could buy something, could be completed in 3, 4 years, and they would make $500,000 on it. But it's changed. My wife 4 years ago wanted to buy an apartment in West Van, a pre-sale, and they were selling at such a high price. I said, "There's no way. These are so overpriced. You're so overpriced. It's insane." And so I didn't buy it. And then all of a sudden, the people that bought it lost their shirt. I mean, I've sold one that, you know, they're losing $600,000, $700,000 for a $4 to $5 million house. Other house I appraised at 9, they bought it for 12.9. So that's how much has changed. So the pre-sales aren't what they used to be, because you could guarantee you buy a pre-sale and you're going to make a good profit on it. Well, it's not that. It isn't happening now.
Are builders a good indicator of the market, as they tend to have an inventory of homes?
Well, it's changed. I sold, just for example, in the properties, Jimmy Patterson, I sold a house for him years ago, and I sold it for $76,000. And I remember him saying to me, "Alan, you're going to be a great realtor." But he would, so you know, when you're in your 20s, you think, "Oh, wow, that's impossible." I hope he's right. But I sold the lot for $76,000. Then I sold it just about 4 years ago for $7 million, and it was the house next to his, and it was basically a teardown. In fact, the one in the 70s, it was old then. So she wouldn't let me in the house, so I sold the lot. And I sold one on the same street for 5.9 that I sold it in for 70,000 too. And I knew at the time, I said, these guys shouldn't be buying this. There's no way they're going to lose their shirt. And these were builders. They both put $500,000 down. And I told my clients, well, we better hope these complete because they're stupid to be buying this at this time. And sure, and they're both going to build. Sure enough, they had 6 months completions, and they did complete. And then the market changed. The market changed so much. Neither of them built. Because I said to my owners, I said, these guys, if they were smart, would walk away. But the realtors don't study the market as I do. And they should walk away from their $500,000. But they didn't. So they completed. Market changed. They couldn't build. They sold one at 7, we sold for 5, and the one at 5.9, we sold for 4.2. So they both lost their shirt. But that's an example of the realtors doesn't just, you know, realtors are like everybody else. If you have a doctor, a lawyer, there's two or three in Canada that are sensational. Then there's a couple of good, then there's all the rest. That's my philosophy in life. I held the Canadian record in the mile. I was the best runner, and then that's a realtor. And you deal with the people at the top, but, you know, there's so few people that you get to know who are at the top. So you deal with what I call all the rest. That's why God got them in so bad, because they're all the rest. And the trouble with this is that, you know, you deal with your realtor, your neighbor's son or daughter just started, and it's tough. Like I spend, as I said, 20 hours a week, nothing to do with my clients and nothing with the office, just studying the market. I'm the only guy that spends all these. I have all these sales for all these, you know, Squamish, Tri-Cities, and Howe Sound, Maple Ridge, all of them, from since 1983 or at least by 91. That tells me so much information. And it's like I had to do a house appraisal in Chartwell last week. It's on the market with their son, and it hasn't sold. And, you know, so I said, well, here's why it hasn't sold. Because they asked, well, how come you don't think it sold? I said, well, it's easy. Right now in Chartwell, you have 72 houses for sale. 72. You have 12 sales by the end of June, two a month. Two into 72, that means that's 36 months to sell the existing product if no more come on the market. So what chance, so everybody wants more than their house is, but most people don't know how to, you know, they don't waste time doing the stats and that. But when I sit there, if it's your house, I say, Jim, look at two out of 72. If your house isn't the best price one on the market, then there's no chance to sell. Because everybody wants to start too high. Then they follow it down, but it was too high to start with, and then it continues going down. That's why they don't sell. And so you need that information. I'm just doing house in the properties that was too high. It was on for 4, 6, 7, and I said it should be in the 3s. And after an hour, I convinced them to drop. And they said, well, my best friend, one lives in Burnaby, one lives in Richmond. They say the market's great. I said, well, here's my charts. They're having the second worst year that they've ever had. So people don't know what goes on. And the realtors won't take the time to learn it. Or they might not know. See, most people don't know. When I started selling houses, I stuttered so badly. I went to law school. Nobody would hire me. 7 interviews said, Mr. Angel, you come and say your name, Alan Mark Angel. So I became a realtor. But I had to develop a system. That system of stats that I thought would work, because I went to the real estate office. Like I got hired because I hire anybody who walks in the door. The realtors go to open houses in the morning, and they sit there and drink coffee in the afternoon. So, and I have, I mean, I start so badly. If there was a price I couldn't say, I would say, well, it's above, you know, $380,000 or something. And I say, it's higher than that. So they would guess the number, and they say, that's it. That's how bad it was, you see. But my system made me the top realtor in Canada in 8 years because people love seeing this stuff. They knew the truth about the market. That's how important it is.
This week, the Bank of Canada dropped the bank rate by another 0.25% to 4.5%. Is it getting tougher and tougher to borrow mortgage money, and will this bank rate decrease matter?
Well, it Yes, it. I mean, you'd think of it. It was 6.5-7%. It's coming down. That's why I'm optimistic about the market. We need two things to change. In Canada and the States, the governments have to change. We have to have a more positive approach and things have to change. But that's what, one of the reasons I'm optimistic, because the rates, I mean, you know, I remember when I never thought they would go down to 10, 19, 20%. Then they would never get to 10. So this is coming down. So it's changing the attitude. Like these eight sub-areas that are all the worst ever. There's still eight, but they're now getting so close to what, you know, the worst is. So they're going to probably pass the worst year. So these eight are having the worst year, but they're growing closer and closer to what's going on. You know, they're, you know, 565 is the worst, but the, I mean, is the it, what they are. But then this one's at 609. So, but it used to be 100 behind. And so the sales are increasing because I think the attitude is increasing.
Is pressure from China's failing real estate market and economy causing people from China to sell their real estate holdings in Greater Vancouver?
Oh, it's absolutely staggering. The Chinese would never sell. My biggest Chinese client bought 32 houses. I could never get her to sell anything at all. They just want to hold on to them. Now, all of a sudden, there's as many Chinese houses coming on the market as there is Iranian or Caucasians. So it's just amazing how the attitude has changed here. Every day there's listings and there's Chinese owners, every day. One thing I was going to do, I thought this morning, there's 529 houses for sale in West Van. I'd like to see how many of those are Chinese by someone. That's a lot of counting I got to do. So, but I'll probably find some time to do that because, you know, they never sold. I said, well, the Chinese, I never, so you sell them once and that's it. Or maybe they buy a second or a third house. No, it's changed greatly, especially the high end because, they're, you know, the Chinese, and they buy the high end.
Are you seeing any signs of panic selling in the high end?
No, I can't say I haven't, you know, there hasn't been, there was one what I thought was a great sale. It was an oceanfront. It was probably worth, you know, it was worth 12 before, but then it was probably worth 9.5 to 10, and she sold for 7.2. But, so that looks like bank, but she has lots of money. She lost her husband. She wanted to be out of the house, so she did get, money didn't mean anything. She just wanted to be gone. So that's the only one that looks like bank. There are some prices that, you know, they're taking less, but most of them try and hold out.
As selling prices drop, are the valuations of surrounding properties affected negatively?
Well, yeah. Every sale, that's why I get mad at the board. I said, we need the actual sales for this month because one sale can change the whole world. And that's why, and as I said, because so that's why I go through every sale that happens. I want to see what. But yes, every house is getting less and less. But you know, that sounds bad. But you know, if you're not going to move for 5-10 years, who cares?
In real estate downturns, do sales drop first, followed by prices?
Yes, they do. The sales, because every owner wants more than his house is worth, so he's going to hold on as long as possible. So as sales get less and less, and a realtor goes in there and says, look at like 72 listings and there's only been 12 sales all year, so that's dropping, you know, that means you have to drop your price to get the place sold. That's why you have to check every sale that goes through in your area. I count the sales in all these other areas, but I look at every sale in West Van to see what is going on.
Lots of for sale signs are popping up everywhere. Do sellers still think their homes are worth what they were selling for at the peak of the market in early 2022?
No, they're educated enough now to know that they're going to get less. You know, they're always too high, but they know they're going to get less. It's easier to convince them this is what's going on. They ask about every sale in their area, and you tell them, oh, I know that house. It's nicer than mine, so I'm not going to get as much as that. So, you know, people, real estate is your biggest investment. People really pay attention to it.
Are first-time buyers still being kept out of the market?
Well, it's a very good question. Yes, it's very, very tough on them. But what's happened, I've had more first-time buyers this year than I've had the last 2 or 3 years. The reason for that is that every single one of them, their parents are there buying them a place. Before, it was the first-time buyers trying to buy it themselves. Now the parents realize, my kids are never going to be able to own a house. So if you're, you know, if you've got enough money to help them, that's what's going on.
The bank of mom and dad.
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
Where do you think the housing market in Greater Vancouver and especially West Vancouver is heading for the rest of the year?
Well, I think for a while it's going to be slower, but I think it'll get, you know, it'll still be slow, but it'll get a little strong. It won't be good. It may not be average, but it'll be better than the worst, which has been done. Yeah, see, last year was the second worst. 2018 was the worst year ever. Last 2 years were the second or in third year worst year of all time. It's interesting. That's all the areas. The best area last year was Whistler, and that was the fifth worst year in history. The fifth worst. That was the best. Everybody else was either you know, the worst, the second worst, maybe the third worst. But you got to realize, the last 7 years, we've had the worst 5 years. Since 2018, we've had the worst 5 years in history. You think of it. We had 372 houses last year in West Van. Okay, the average is 739. The best is over 1,200. So that's how far away we are from having the average or the best. So, you know, we're definitely due for a change, but we need the world to stabilize. We need the world to stabilize so people feel more secure. The rates are, you know, 4.5, but I mean, yes, it's high compared to housing, but those rates we had for a couple of years, you could never see anything like that. Never seen anything like that. So, you know, we're paying the price, but even if it goes down to 4, 3.75, that's still a great rate.
Are people still selling and then buying another home in the same area?
Yes, the majority of them are. Some are, I would say maybe 20% are selling and then going to rent for 6 months or a year. But the rest are still buying because, you know, the house you sell is less, but the house you're buying is less.
Are people still flipping properties for profit?
No, you can't do that. There's no chance. And now we've got the taxes on. If you flip it in 2 years, you've got the taxes you have to pay. I haven't had anybody flip a house in 2 or 3 years.
How important is it for both buyers and sellers to pay attention to stats?
Stats tells you the whole world. The whole world, honest to goodness. If realtor does his stats properly, that's everything you need to know. When I told that to a woman the other day that, you know, the 72 houses, you know, she was shocked. She says, "Oh, you're the only brother who uses stats like that. That's so important. I'm overwhelmed." That's why. But you see, now I'm a nutcase about stats, but I do, you know, 14 areas. And then I do the apartments in 8 areas. Okay, apartment sales are much stronger. Apartment sales are not discussing the worst. They're at the average, like in Greater Vancouver apartments, for example, the average is 9,608. By the end of June, we're at over 10,000 here. The best is 17,000, but apartments are over the average sale. And think all but maybe of the 8, all but 2, but they're way above the worst. So that's the good thing.
Is now a good time to be buying or selling?
I would, you know, everybody tries to wait. I want to time it perfectly. You can't time it perfectly because you don't know. I mean, I know more than just about everybody because this is what I do. But, you know, I can't be sure. I just hope I'm right. But if you're going to sell the next 2 or 3 years, you don't buy. Okay, you don't buy. But most people live 10, 12 years in a house, and they think, well, I'm going to wait till the market. I know really the market is really close to bottom, but then they won't find the house they like. They won't find the house they like because they wait and wait, and now they have to buy. Because if you find a house you like, you love, if you're going to live there for 10, 12 years, I'll still buy it today.
Something like 50,000 people a year move into the Greater Vancouver area. What are their hopes of finding a place to live?
Well, you see, that one of the reasons we expanded to go to Langley and that. You could buy a $1 million house out there. Here, you can't, you know, you got to pay 2.5 for a normal lot, a 50-foot lot. So these other areas are doing well.
So getting away from Vancouver proper.
Yeah, you have to. Like, I was amazed. Because we have offices in Port Moody and out there, I just sold a house out in Port Moody for $6.1 million a couple of weeks ago.
Wow.
Now, that's a lot of money out there. But the fact of the matter is, if I had to show that on a Friday night from where, it's 2-hour drive to get there. You know, people have bought 2-hour drive, spent an hour and a half there. It was an hour and a half home. That was 5 hours for one showing. When I opened the Whistler office, I couldn't go in December when we opened it because I just had my new knee. And, but we drove up, you know, a couple months later, and I thought, God, from Coffee, it was only an hour and a quarter. And it was a nice drive. I said, it's shorter to go to Whistler now than it is to go to Port Moody or Langley. So, you know, sometimes it's better. Yes, you have to drive further, but you can buy a cheaper house. And you got to be real estate. Everyone needs real estate holdings.
Alan, where can people follow you and contact you?
Best way is my cell phone. Our website, angelhasman.ca. Angel is A-N-G-E-L-L. Hasman, H-A-S-M-A-N. So it's Alan Angel, Malcolm Hasman, own the company. Angelhasman.ca. My cell phone is where I'm always on, 778-888-7474. So very 778-888-7474.
Alan, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been Alan Mark Angel. Coming up, Wolf Richter, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt, ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of wolfstreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
After moving significantly higher, stock markets are now pulling back. Do you think the stock markets are starting to catch a cold?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. Obviously, the rally we've seen since last year has been like generational, and so huge percentage increases in the big stocks, and then gigantic dollar increases. So the big seven stocks here that we call the Magnificent Seven. So that's Amazon, Alphabet, Tesla, Nvidia. The others, and they have surged so much that three of them at one point were worth over $3 trillion each, and all combined were over $12 trillion. That's $12 trillion, you know, for seven stocks. That's a huge amount of money. And so they have started to sell off, and they have, through that rally, it was so, those stocks that pulled the S&P 500 up. And the small caps were really not doing well at all. I mean, they're at levels that have been years ago. And so these seven big stocks pulled up the overall indices. And so July 10th is when they suddenly started turning around. So that's when they hit the peak. And since then, they have zigzagged lower pretty hard. And they're down about 10% combined. So that's a correction, but the dollar amounts are so huge. We're looking at close to $2 trillion there in amounts that they've given up. And so that has a large impact on the rest of the stock market indices. And it is definitely a major change in how the direction of the market went, and you look at a chart, and it doesn't look very good. I mean, today's Friday. It's in the middle of the day when we're recording this. The markets haven't closed yet. And then there was a huge rally today, but it looks like it's fading now, going into the end of the day. And we've seen that. We've had, on a day basis, we've had rallies that early in the day that then fizzled and ended the day with a loss. We've had that several times. And so this is very different from what we saw before July 10th. And so something has changed. And now stocks reporting kind of iffy, companies reporting kind of iffy forecasts, and the stocks just get crushed. Like Ford yesterday got hammered down by 18%. And I mean, this happens time after time. And Tesla got hammered down a whole bunch the other day. And the semiconductor stocks, when they report something that's not quite 100%, I mean, they get hammered down. And so when we're at these elevated valuations, that's what we're seeing. So it looks to me like the market has probably gone up as far as it's going to go for a while, and this is probably going to be a downward trend from here on forward.
What do you see happening in the U.S. housing market?
Yeah, that's what we're seeing now is. Vacant homes coming on the market in fairly large numbers, and we didn't see that before. We now see it, and what happened is during the pandemic is that home prices rose so fast that when people bought a new house and moved, they moved out of the old house but kept the old house to run up the price all the way to the top. It's sort of an investment, often a leveraged investment, and maybe they thought they'd rent it out, or maybe they thought they put short-term rentals on it, thought they would sell it later when at a maximum price. And so those houses are not coming on the market. And these people that did that, they're not buying another house. They already bought it. So that's what caused inventory to go down during the pandemic, and now inventory is going up by a lot and without increasing sales. Sales are down 25-30% from pre-pandemic times in terms of people that have to have a mortgage to buy a home. Those sales are down by half. So the cash deals are still happening at a low volume, but they're still happening. The mortgage deals they're down by about half. So that end of the market has just collapsed. And of course, our 30-year fixed rate mortgage right now is still around 7%. And at these prices, at these very high prices that we have, that just doesn't make a lot of sense. So we have seen sales collapse, and they got worse in June. Of all the bad months we've had, they got even worse in June. And now everybody's waiting for rate cuts from the Fed. So that causes more hesitation in the market and more people to not buy now. And so we have this declining sales. We have a rising inventory. And so the supply has now jumped to over 4 months. And that's the highest we've seen in years. So we've got those dynamics. We've got more inventory coming on the market, vacant houses coming on the market. The sellers aren't buying. They've already bought. So this increases the inventory without increasing sales. Sales have plunged. Sales requiring a mortgage have plunged by half. And then we've seen big institutional investors. So these are the big companies that buy houses and rent them out, and they have tens of thousands of houses. They start buying. They turned into net sellers of these individual houses that they bought during the housing bust in 2012. And they've announced that in the earnings calls, and they're getting rid of those houses that are scattered all over the place. What they have switched to is building their own. So some of these big rental firms have their own home building divisions, and they're building entire subdivisions of rental homes with a leasing office and a maintenance office, and it's much more efficient to run this. It's called Built to Rent, and it's the biggest thing in construction right now, and home builders got massively into it. They're building entire Built to Rent communities with a leasing office and amenities, common amenities for the tenants, and they're selling those to, they're either renting them out themselves and keeping them, and they all have big rental divisions, or they're selling them to pension funds after they've already been rented out, or to other institutional investors. So we're seeing that institutional investors are now, the big ones, are now selling individual houses. They're building their own for rental purposes, but they're sell- so they're putting new inventory in the housing stock, but it's not for sale, it's for rent, and they're building that, and then they're selling the for sale inventory. They're putting houses on the for sale market. So these are really big movements, and prices have come down in some cities, and they have gone up in others, and what we're seeing now is a shift to the high end. People have gotten very rich in the stock market recently, and they're paying cash for houses. That is particularly true in the San Francisco Bay Area and other areas where some of the AI bubble is taking place. And so the high end is moving, and that is shifting the median price up, and we've seen that. The sales have plunged dramatically at the mid to lower range, and they're up a little bit actually year over year in the high end, in the luxury end. And so that shifts the median price up. And so these are the dynamics we see in the U.S. housing market, and it's interesting to look at the inventory that's now coming on the market that people said is not there. You know, it's coming out of the woodwork. These vacant houses that people said weren't there, they're now coming out of the woodwork, and they're showing up on the market, and they're not coming with sales. You know, because these people already bought the house, so there's no sale associated, so there's no purchase associated with that. It's just a piece of inventory that's there now. And so I think that the housing market is just having to deal with that. I mean, that should have happened a long time ago. Prices are way too high. Affordability is terrible. This is a healthy thing for the economy. And I mean, it's not a particularly healthy thing for people that lent to that market, but we really haven't had any major problems with mortgages going bad. So I think we're going to watch this work out over time.
What are you seeing in the Canadian housing market?
Well, amazingly, maybe not so amazingly, that's an entirely different market for the main reason that your mortgages are so different. We have a 30-year fixed rate mortgage here, and that means that nothing changes on your mortgage for 30 years. If you don't move, you have the same payment for 30 years. And in the Canadian housing market, you have variable rate mortgages that adjust very quickly. You have so-called fixed rate mortgages that are not really fixed rate in the American sense, in the U.S. sense, but they're fixed rate for terms such as 2 years or 5 years, and then they adjust. So current homeowners were quickly impacted by the higher mortgage rates, and that's not happening in the United States. Current homeowners don't feel the higher mortgage rates. It's the new buyers that are feeling them. And in Canada, that's not the case, although pretty quickly the higher mortgage rates translated into pain for current homeowners. And so we've seen that with consumers. Consumers have cut back some. The Canadian housing market in terms of sales is down. Prices overall, according to the Canadian Real Estate Association, are down about 14% for single-family houses. And in Canada, about 15% for single-family houses from the peak in 2022 in Toronto. In Toronto, the condo market is in really bad shape. They're now at multi-year lows in their pricing. Other cities have hit new highs, like Calgary and Quebec. And so it's different by city. But the Toronto market is the one that got hit the hardest, and it really hasn't turned around. And especially in condo land, there's some major problems there now, and it will take a while to work out. There probably was substantial overbuilding of condos, and there's just no real way to deal with this other than to let the market do its job and balance this out.
The Bank of Canada has cut its central rate twice already by a quarter point, from 5% to 4.5%. Do you think the Fed will follow the Bank of Canada and cut interest rates this week?
Yeah, so the market, the financial markets, and just about everybody else here is just about 100% convinced that the Fed will cut in September. And so there's not really any expectation that it will cut in July, so next week, but that it will cut in September. And the conviction is such that it makes me nervous. Yeah, because the Fed isn't 100% convinced. And they haven't, they said they, if inflation tracks like they expected, so goes down, continues to go down like they expected, they will cut pretty soon. That could be in September, that could be later. And but if inflation is if inflation is not doing that, then they may wait and see some more. And we just got our latest inflation data today, and the six-month rate for the core PCE price index, which is what the Fed looks at, rose to the highest level in a year. It's at 3.4% today for June, and the Fed target for that metric is 2%, and it's going in the wrong direction. The month-to-month rates are incredibly volatile. We've had some big, massive revisions today, upward revisions, and so it's very hard to rely on this data. I'm just looking at 1 month, and that's one of the reasons why the Fed has been in this wait-and-see position, because the data just is all over the place. It was really low late last year, and then it got very high earlier this year, and then it backed off some, and now we see this increase. And yeah, it's very difficult to tell where inflation is going. It looks like it's going up when you look at the data today, and the 6 month rate. So that's the last 6 months averaged out over a year, and yeah, that's going higher. that means that the last 6 months, that's the trend. And we had really low inflation late last year, so that was before the six-month trend. Now we're going to get into the second half here pretty soon, and the year-over-year rates will then be less favorable as well. So, you know, I think there's a pretty good chance that we get several more not great or maybe worse inflation readings until the September meeting, and if that's the case, it may be that the Fed will not cut, that it will say, well, we're just going to wait and see some more. The economy is doing fine. You know, the economy is not blowing up, and the labor market is holding up, and it's not like they have to cut very quickly because the economy is slowing. It's not. They're fairly high in their rates at 5.5%, and inflation on an annual basis is above their target, but it's lower, substantially lower than 5.5%. So, you know, they have room to cut. They can cut because, you know, inflation is quite a bit lower than their policy rate. But if they cut and then inflation continues to rise suddenly in the second half, as the early indicators say that they might, they may have to hike rates again. And that is something Powell has mentioned. And that is not a good scenario. So the Fed would prefer to not have to rehike after a cut, and I think there's a good chance that they're not going to cut in September.
Could Canada and the U.S. end up like Japan did with very low interest rates and banks that refuse to lend?
Well, Japan had very low interest rates, but the issue wasn't that banks refused to lend. There was simply no demand from the private sector, little demand. The households, which used to be heavily indebted in Japan, back in the 1990s, they've cut way back, so they're now, they don't have a lot of debt, and corporate indebtedness is not bad. What's indebted in Japan is the government, and that is horribly indebted. So a lot of the debt has shifted from the private sector to the government. In the private sector, there's just not a lot of demand for borrowing, and especially from consumers, and banks would like to lend, but there's just not a lot of demand. And that has marked the Japanese economy for a long time. And that could happen in the United States, but I don't see that. You know, I don't see that demand for lending is going to dry up, and you know, households continue to borrow in the United States. That's not a problem. You know, Americans love to borrow, and especially for housing. So that's a thing in Japan that happened. The home prices fell for decades. So the loans required to buy a home shrank with the home prices, and that went on for decades. So you see household borrowing go down because home prices fell and mortgages the mortgage amounts fell. And that's the biggest part of borrowing from consumers is mortgages. And so when you have a housing market that contracts for decades, the mortgage lending will obviously contract for decades. And I don't see that happening here for decades. We could. I mean, we've had a phenomenal housing bubble here, which is phenomenal. And it could be that it's like a Japanese scenario where it takes many, many years of you know, relatively small annual declines, maybe some upticks that drag out for a long time until homes become affordable again. And that could be a scenario. I don't really see that either because inflation is here, and it wasn't in Japan, and we have wage increases, and they really didn't have any wage increases. They had wage declines in Japan, where new workers got paid less than the workers that got in there the year or two before, and that's been going on for decades. So, it's not that people got wage cuts, they just didn't get any raises, and the new workers got paid less. And I don't see that happening in the United States either. So there is a different scenario, and I don't envision a scenario where banks refuse to lend. I mean, that happens during a credit crunch. They're relatively brief when banks get in trouble, and that happens in commercial real estate. Of course, they don't really refuse to lend to good projects. They're refusing to lend to projects that don't make sense. Now interest rates are 7%, 8% for commercial real estate. You can't lend on a project that's designed for 3%, that's making money at 3%, but is losing money at 5%, and higher. So, you know, that sector is struggling in the United States, and there's not a lot of lending going on, and projects are on hold because they can't get financing, and when loans mature, they default because they can't be replaced, and they can't be refinanced. And so we have that problem, but that's one sector of the economy, and the others are not really impacted by that. So I think that the overall situations are very, very different between what Japan was several decades ago when they entered the scenario and the United States now.
We hear about electric vehicle production being scaled back, but is production of all vehicles being scaled back due to the economy?
And so what's scaled back is not EV production, it's the EV production plants. So they had plants, meaning Ford and GM, the legacy automakers in the United States, not necessarily the Koreans, they had plans to ramp up production very rapidly of EVs. And they have scaled that production ramp up back. So they're going to grow production more slowly, but they're still going to grow production. And EV sales by GM and Ford have risen by 40%, 50%, 60% year over year this year so far. And that's the only thing they have for sales rising. The ICE vehicles, so without EVs included, they actually fell year over year. So that's the growth they have is in EVs. And except the growth is not as fast as they expected. And they have a dealer revolt on their hands. Half of the dealers refuse to sell EVs, and the legacy automakers cannot get around the dealer network. So if the dealers are unenthusiastic about selling EVs, then they're hard to sell. So that's that issue. And Tesla doesn't have that issue, and other EV startups don't have that issue, but the legacy automakers have that. And there's ways to kind of get around it, but they're still having that problem. And also when Ford is selling an EV truck, a Lightning, that replaces an ICE truck that it doesn't sell. So it doesn't really make any additional sales with that. It just cannibalizes its ICE sales. And then ICE trucks are very, very profitable for Ford. I mean, they have obscene profit margins on them. Americans are willing to pay whatever for these trucks. And that's been the case for decades. They're, I think, way overpriced. They're really expensive now. And and so they don't, they're replacing that with an EV truck that has to compete with other EV trucks where price cutting has now taken place, and so Ford doesn't really have a lot of appetite for that, and so you see that, you know, Ford stock plunged 18% yesterday when they announced their financial quarterly earnings, and for, you know, they had warranty issues and that other stuff, and they're losing so much money on the EVs. They're losing a lot of money because they're not ramping up production enough. They're still at a low volume. And Tesla lost a lot of money when it was at a low volume. You have to have a large scale production output to make any manufacturing work, and they're not getting there. They're slowing down the ramp up, so it takes them longer to get there, so they're going to lose more money over time. And it's just stupid decision making when you think about it, but they have a dealer revolt on their hands. They can't force the dealers to sell EVs, so I mean, what are they going to do? And it may be in the future that you have dedicated EV makers, and they're competing with dedicated ICE makers, and that there may be some foreign makers like the Koreans that are able to manage both. But maybe Ford and GM, they may not be able to really get there because they're cannibalizing the ICE sales with the EV sales, and the ICE sales are profitable, and the EV sales at the low volume are not. And so it's a tough situation. They waited 10 years too long. They should have gone started playing that game 10 years ago, and they're way behind. And Stellantis doesn't have any EVs out there yet. You know, and GM is just putting some new models on the market now. They killed its boat and putting new models out. And they're doing well, starting to sell, you know, but they're very small volume still. So, you know, that's the problem they're having. And now the market is... year over year, yeah, we're up a little bit from a year ago. Some of that is from the import brands, and some of it is from EVs, and then there's not a lot left for growth in terms of Ford's and GM's ICE vehicles. And there's huge amounts of inventory on the market, especially by the Stellantis brands. I mean, they're sitting on 150-day supply. There's a, you know, European takeover of an American company that sells pickups and Jeeps. I mean, you think about the contradiction there. I mean, there's a bunch of European people telling Americans how to sell Jeeps and pickups. And, you know, they need to cut their prices. They're expensive, and they refuse to do that. Well, obviously, they're now discussing price cuts because inventory is piling up. You can't sell these high-priced trucks that way. And they should cut prices. They have increased their prices by extraordinary amounts during the pandemic. They got incredibly greedy, and now the sales have stalled. And that's not a surprise. And they need to cut the prices massively. And yeah, that's going to cost their profit margins. But they should have never hiked the prices like they did, and it's biting them in the butt. So, they have catastrophic amounts of inventory on their hand, and they, it's Stellantis dealers, you know, and they have to do something. And to do something means cutting prices.
Yeah, the CEO of Stellantis says the company cannot afford to have brands that don't make money. Could an auto industry shakeout be ahead?
Yeah, so it was a huge mistake for a European company to buy an American pickup truck maker. That's the European brands of Stellantis, they're small cars. They're compact cars. They're small, compact SUVs. And they're selling them in a very different market. And so now they're trying to deal with this American market. And the shakeout is underway. The shakeout is coming from Tesla. And Tesla has barged into this market with price cuts. And I think that's great. You know, that's what Americans need. They need price cuts. And especially after the price spike during the pandemic. And it still makes money. It's still profitable. And it has a very aggressive pricing strategy here in the United States. And it's put a stop to the price hikes at the legacy automakers. They hike their prices. They're not selling anything. And so the inventory sits. So that's the shakeout. I think the industry will have to cut prices by the ICE vehicle makers will have to cut prices by a substantial amount. And EV makers have to compete with each other on price. And There are new ones on the market now. We have two new pickup truck makers now that we didn't have before. We have Tesla and Rivian, and they're making electric pickup trucks. And volume is still relatively small compared to the ICE pickup truck that the other automakers are making. And Ford and GM have now electric pickup trucks also, but there's these two new entrants into the pickup truck market that we didn't have before. So the competitive environment has changed. And the whole auto industry is due for a shakeout. It's been self-satisfied and oligopolistic for decades. And the last big shakeup they had was when the Korean automakers moved in. And that was 1980s, early 1990s when that started working. And that's good. I would love to see a big shakeup in the auto industry. It needs that.
Are auto manufacturers going to have to offer significant discounts to help dealerships move product?
Yeah, especially Stellantis dealers, but also Ford and GM dealers. Some of the imports are still pretty tight on inventory, but they're coming up too. But at the U.S. legacy automakers, they've got a massive inventory problem on their hands. So, like I mentioned, price cuts is going to have to be the solution to this inventory buildup. And when they can cut production too, and that's even more expensive than price cuts. So, they have enormous profit margins on these, especially on these big vehicles, on these pickup trucks and big SUVs. And they can cut, and they still are profitable, but they're not as profitable as they were. And of course, that's anathema to CEOs to cut the profits like that. But Americans are not buying these high priced trucks. It's just that, you know, they're sitting and so price cuts. I mean, we've seen the used vehicle market adjust to that. Used vehicle prices are down in a massive way. Yeah, they have unwound over half of the price spike during the pandemic. New vehicles haven't done that, and especially the expensive trucks haven't done that. They're just sitting on the lot. And the solution is price cuts. And Americans need it. It's good for consumers. It'll eventually be good for the industry. Greed is never a good thing for an industry. I mean, when you try to get the maximum price and sales collapse, I mean, that's bad. You know, that's you have your inventory sitting around, you got a problem. And so they have to address that.
Wolf, before we go, can you tell us a little bit about Wolf Street?
WolfStreet.com. It's free. There's no paywall. It's just business, finance, and money.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Alan Mark Angel, and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.